And it's 5 p.m. here at WVEWLP 107.7 FM, Brattleboro Community Radio. And welcome to another edition of the Right Action Radio Hour. Your host this afternoon is Edmund Brelsford. And in the midst of this marvelous weekend of literary festival, I've managed to pluck from among our readers Vincent Pennella. He just read for us yesterday at the Right Action Showcase of local authors, and who could resist? Vincent is here in the studio with me, and welcome.
Thank you, Edmund. Thank you, Edmund, and thank you for having me on your show.
A pleasure indeed. And I think maybe we're looking at something called Lost Hearts, a collection of short stories which has just appeared. And perhaps you could give us a little intro or rundown on this collection.
Okay. Lost Hearts is a collection of 23 stories which were originally written as separate stories, and which I decided after a while that they really formed a continuum of generations. The 23 stories span three generations of the same family and the same set of characters. The opening story is set in Sicily, and it deals with the grandfather, the paternal grandfather of the family. The subsequent stories deal with his descendants in the United States, and takes them basically from, not quite from birth to death, but to almost to that point. So the stories which begin in 1900 in Sicily end up today, in today's world.
Well, Sicily. Have you been there?
Many times. Family in Sicily. My mother's family, my maternal half are Sicilian. They come from a small town called Petrolia Soprana, which I've visited several times. I still communicate with my cousins there by email. I think the last time I was there was about a year ago.
Uh-huh.
It's a pretty typical Italian place in the sense that it's remote. It's the highest town in the province of Palermo. It's one of those little towns with built on the top of a mountain, which is where the Sicilians went to hide from the evils down below. And it's a kind of a timeless place, which my grandfather said there was nothing there, and so he came here. But there's still not really very much there. But
uh-huh.
It's still a beautiful place, and it's very, I find it very easy for me to write about Sicily because I think I have so many sort of internal associations with it, with my grandparents. My grandmother and grandfather on my mother's side were both from the same town. Their houses are still there. And visiting those places and actually visiting those places, it's kind of like being in a mystery because my grandmother and grandfather spoke basically a dialect which I didn't understand, although they spoke broken English, a dialect which I refused to learn when I was young. So the whole area has a kind of, I have a desire to know it that I wouldn't have if I were able to speak Italian when I was young. And so since they spoke this really different dialects, quite different from the standard kind of Italian, it was even a more of a mysterious place to me, and so I think I'm constantly reaching for that mystery when I write about it.
Hmm. Yeah, I understand this, because of course there's the national language, and then there's Siciliano, but then which Siciliano?
Exactly. There are probably as many dialects as there are towns, and the interesting part is most of those people there speak actually two languages. They can speak the Italian they learned in books, and they can speak the Italian to each other if they don't, which, like my family when I grew up, they did not want me to know about, and they can speak to each other. It kind of sounds like typewriter, like a manual typewriter when they talk, but it is a beautiful in its own way, and actually you can listen to that language in movie, and now in a lot of the gangster movies you can hear some of it. The Godfather was very good for The Godfather 1 for rendering the Sicilian language, and
yeah.
You could see that one of the reasons for the popularity of the movie, I think, was that it brought back. And you see this also in the performer, now deceased, Louis Prima, who some people call him the Italian Louis Armstrong. But he has some Sicilian songs,
mm-hmm.
where he works in the Sicilian dialect. And obviously in Las Vegas, I mean, the crowds just go crazy when they hear him bring up those old words. And I. even myself, as sort of corny as it is, I have a real deep association with that. It's mm-hmm. because of language and what you hear as a boy. When I was a little boy, I was listening, sitting in those rooms, listening to these people and not knowing what they were saying.
Yeah.
So
oh,
I was
yeah.
constantly trying to figure it out.
Well, when I lived in Sicily, of course I had the national language. But I was there with on a Marlborough semester with a bunch of students, and one of the students was equally fluent in Spanish, French, what have you, as am I. And we were leaving a supermarket in, let's see, where were we? Oh yeah, we were in Lipari. And these little plastic bags that you get in the supermarket to carry your things in, there's a little sign that said 35 lire caduna. Caduna, but that should be ciascuna in Italian. Caduna, and then we clicked, oh yeah, Sicily was part of the kingdom of the two Sicilies under Spanish domination for two centuries. There's an underlay here of Spanish as well.
And, French and Spanish, and Arabic.
And then were the French, and the Arabs had been there before, right. And the Normans came along and dumped the Arabs.
That's why they have so many red-headed, blonde Sicilians and blue-eyed people are surprised at that. But the
amazing,
reason is that the Normans,
it?
Who were the Northmen, who were the Vikings,
here.
Went down to Sicily, and that's why I have red-headed people in my family.
Uh-huh.
My mother, my grandmother had black hair and blue eyes.
Yeah, there you go.
It's
I saw this so often in Sicily.
Yeah, right.
So Fred and I went to a bookstore and got a dictionary, Siciliano, Spanish. And it took us about 3 weeks, and then we could start talking with the masons, the fishermen, what have you, and particularly the young men, in as much as this particular Marlborough semester had six lovely young Marlborough women on it as well. So there was no shortage of young Italian men hanging around
sure
all the time.
I'm sure you got a lot of attention. I'm sure you got a great deal of attention, yes.
But some of the shifts were quite interesting because they were also similar to what was going on in Sardinia and also up in Naples. And the vowel shifts, for instance, there's a town in on the island of Salina called Polara. And as they say there, it's never cold. And also on that same island, Salina, I don't know if you saw Il Postino, the postman,
yes,
film.
It, yeah.
It was filmed on Salina, and that's where we had this semester-long program. But Polara is there, and they say it's never cold there. And the villa that they use for filming Il Postino is there in Polara. And also that spectacular rocky beach with its magnificent cliff rising above it. And then, so in the national language, non si fa freddo a Polara. But in the local dialect, it came out as non si fa freddo a Polara. And suddenly the O had turned to an U. No, it turned to an NU. Hmm? Fridu. Fredo, Fridu. A to E. Hmm? O to U. Yeah.
Right.
Polara, double L, turned into a D.
I think U and A are masculine and feminine for il and la.
Yeah.
And L's go to D's. For example, mm-hmm. Louis, which means he, the pronoun he is idu.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah,
it's pretty funny. It's interesting. Well,
it took us about 3 weeks to find our way. Non si fa freddo a Polara. I had a question about your first story here, because you refer to Peter, and we are in Sicily, and wasn't his name Pietro?
Oh, I'm sure his name was Pietro in Sicily, but mm-hmm. I'm writing for people in this country, so I mm-hmm. like the sound of it. Actually, Peter to me sounded a little... I think I write by sound.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care about verisimilitude often. If
uh-huh.
it sounds good,
uh-huh.
if it fits into the sentences, if it's comfortable in my mind, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume that readers would think that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I called him Pietro, I think it would be slightly uncomfortable to a reader,
mm-hmm.
and maybe to me also.
Uh-huh.
My grandfather's name was Pietro, but... Peter, to me, worked better,
uh-huh.
just purely as a sound, purely as aesthetic
mm-hmm.
choice.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I was curious because here and there, your details on cultural gestures, the hand gestures, eye movements, and that sort of thing, were really, or, you know, in the piazza, capturing so exquisitely the color of Sicily and the Siciliani and how they move and communicate. And suddenly I thought, well, wait a minute, this guy's name's Peter.
Well, I think that's part of the fun of it, and also mm-hmm. part of the. I don't know if I want to say irony, but it's part mm-hmm. of the idea that anyone like Peter, who was born there and had this crazy adventure there, still lives in two worlds.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, so he's in the American world, and he's in the Italian world, or the Sicilian world, and maybe that's one reason why I called him Peter. I don't know.
U.S., you're Peter. Yeah, exactly.
No, but the rest of the part, the gestures and all, I mean, those are the things that I've observed at home in New York, mm-hmm. as well as observed there. But
they come across the sea, don't they? Yeah.
Oh, no, Italians have a whole body language, which I tried to capture not only in that story, but actually in a story.
Yeah, it keeps cropping up.
Yeah, it does keep cropping up. Yeah. Well, the main one is there's a story called Wheelman, which I'd like to read. In which one of the ants in the story has this gesture, which is just a kind of a vibration of her body and a single syllable, meaning I'm right and you're wrong.
Oh, I've seen it and heard it so often.
Like, what did you think, dummy? You know, sort of, that's really what it amounts to.
Yeah, in the villa we had a contadino. Dino was his name, and he kept saying, tutti bravi studenti, all these wonderful students. And then I'd say something to Dino about one of them, which wasn't so good, and he'd say,
Yeah, what do you think? That's the way it is. Yeah.
Perhaps you could give us a flavor by reading one of these stories.
Well, I would like to read the story I mentioned. It's called Wheelman.
Excellent.
And it's really, it's a story about three funerals, and a first-person story of the observer is Charlie Marino, who appears in pretty much throughout this book. He appears in the second story after the Sicily story at age 13, and we follow Charlie and his friends and cousins till the end of this book in stories which actually can be read separately, because I wrote them separately, but I arranged them in such a way that they're chronological so you can follow Charlie through his life. In this story, Charlie is about in his early 20s. He's out of college, but he still has his family to contend with, and it's about Charlie driving his relatives around. Wheelman. While my father attacks his roast pork dinner, Aunt Marie frowns at her ham and poached eggs and says, I don't believe it. She picks up the slice of ham with her fork and calls the waitress, who pads over in scuffed white shoes, pushing a wisp of hair aside. What do you call this? Maria asks. Is this a ham steak or a slice of ham for a sandwich? Before the woman can answer, Marie puts down the ham and cuts through one of the eggs with the edge of her fork. And what's this? What kind of eggs are these? Poached or hard-boiled? Or poached until they're hard-boiled? Hank moves to pick up the plate, saying, she'll take it back. But Marie pushes his hand away and gives him a burst of Italian, which she doesn't think I understand. It's not worth the trouble. These people don't know any better. To emphasize the point, she holds up her thumb and index finger in a pistol shape and swivels her hand. Forget it. There's nothing there. Outside, Queens Boulevard looks like a timed exposure. Cars, trucks, and lights all melted into luminous bands. I'm trying to appear more interested in a turkey club and French fries than the conversation. I pick up more that way. Marie speaks Italian because it feeds into the conspiracy mentality prevalent in the Marino family. Herself, my father, Aunt Gina, she's been dead for a year now, and Uncle Vito, dead for 2 days and lying in a casket a few doors down the street. Now we eat our sorrows and angers away, Hank packing in the roast pork with potatoes and applesauce while I drench the fries in ketchup. Aunt Marie switches to chocolate cream pie after swearing the waitress to its quality as though we're in a court of law. The first night of a funeral is always the worst, and this is no exception. Tonight, my father saw his older brother dead at 52 years. He took one look at Vito and walked back out of the chapel, leaning against the wall and sobbing in the hallway. It was the second time I'd seen him cry. The first was years ago, when he drank so much he couldn't walk, and sat next to my maternal grandmother and cried on her shoulders, and in great heaving sobs, told her what a rotten guy he was, but never explaining why, even though most of us knew what he was talking about. This is a hard first night, even without the crying, with just the fact that Vito was the family Achilles. Strong as a horse, tall, handsome, any woman's dream. The uncle who stood in for my father and took me party boat fishing and to a Yankee game where I saw Joe DiMaggio make an over-the-shoulder catch like it was nothing. Vito even died a hero's death, hit in the head with a garbage pail, thrown from a tenement roof while he was selling ice cream from his truck, a shot as lucky as the arrow of Paris. And he didn't need that job, Marie says, pointing her fork at my father as if she's about to stab him. But you know Vito, he wasn't afraid of anything. He went into the worst neighborhoods. He sold more ice cream there, my father says, not looking up. He'd sawed off a piece of pork and was covering it with potato and applesauce as a prelude to lifting it off the plate. He knew it was useless to argue with Marie, who was always right. Useless to tell her what we all knew, that Uncle Vito needed that job because he was an addicted gambler and his fire department salary couldn't support his family and his habit. Except for women, my father has no such vices, not drinking, not gambling. He'd been a fireman for a few years, then he quit and went into the bar business. Hank's the smart Marino, always work for yourself. He'd like to take that motto back right now because I'm a half year out of college and unemployed, working at his place and living at home. But we're not only drowning our sorrows because of Vito's death. There's a complication. After my mother and Marie, my father and Marie calmed down from the initial shock of seeing their brother laid out like a slab of oak, the funeral director reveals that the burial arrangements are a problem. Even though the Marino family has two plots in Calvary Cemetery, spitting distance from the diner, Uncle Vito can't be buried there because he wasn't a practicing Catholic. Now, is it possible for Vito Marino, an Italian-American and New York City fireman, to not be a practicing Catholic? The funeral director can only repeat what he's been told by the cardinal's office. By virtue of a separation from his first wife and a common law marriage to a second, with whom he had a child, Uncle Vito had fallen afoul of church law and could not be buried in a restricted cemetery. And in a city with millions of such sinners, how was my uncle discovered? By a family member who'd placed a call to the New York Archdiocese and who then admitted what he'd done. That's how stupid he is, Marie says, referring to my older cousin Lenny, who'd married a Seventh-day Adventist and converted. He's an idealist, my father said. But the wife egged him on, Marie says, lapsing into English because it's all right for me to know this. She's more of a screwball than he is. The question is why, my father asked. I'll tell you why. Because he'd like nothing better than to rub the Pope's face in the dirt. If Gina was alive, she'd slap some sense into him. Marie raises her hand, fingers together, and makes a well-understood chopping motion. She was too easy on that kid. The mention of Gina silences the table. Gina was the older sister, the surrogate mother for Vito, Hank, and Marie. When Grandpa Marino's wife died, he was running a grocery store in Brooklyn and worked long hours while the children were left to the care of Gina, the family ugly duckling as Marie was its beauty. Gina was a female Vito, a brick, tough as nails, fast with her hands, a terror with a wooden spoon or any weapon within reach, including a homemade device Lenny once showed me, a cut-off broom handle with a heavy leather strap attached to one end with friction tape. Corporal punishment was a Marino tradition. My father ignores Marie's remarks about Gina being too easy on Lenny. If anything, it had been the opposite, but none of this talk addresses the problem of how to bury Uncle Vito in the family plot. Tomorrow, he says, we go downtown. For what? To visit the Cardinal. The next morning, I take the wheel of my father's Oldsmobile Starfire. He sits beside me, dressed in a dark suit. He's shaved so close he must have gone over his face three times. Aunt Marie is wearing a gold crucifix and so much black lace she looks like the Spanish Inquisition. We take Queens Boulevard past Calvary Cemetery with its giant statue of Christ, then we cross the 59th Street Bridge. My father keeps his back to the passenger door so he can give me directions and talk to Marie, who sits with both arms resting on the seat back. We head over the river into Manhattan, the UN building a blazing wall of sun, the skyline as clear in the morning light as an architect's model. Traffic on the bridge is stop and go, and during the stops I take up at times and half read, half listen to my father and Marie speaking Italian in their conspiratorial voices. He's asking about our husband Steve. They've been separated for several years, and Steve wants her back. Marie takes one last puff on a cigarette, then opens the window and throws it onto the roadway. The trouble isn't Steve, she said. It's his mother. And what does she have against you? My life. My father removes the cigar from his mouth and examines the wet part. Marie eloped with Steve because Grandpa Marino refused to recognize her as his daughter. Steve's mother knew this. The story of Marie's banishment was never spoken about, but I got it from Lenny's younger brother, Anthony, who had it from Aunt Gina. Grandpa Marino ruled his children with an iron fist, and Marie wouldn't submit. She stole his money, ran away with a gangster, had a child and gave it up for adoption, and finally, while she was working in the garment district, she met Steve at a dance and bowled him over. The mother called me a whore. When we told her we were getting married, she wanted to look at the sheets from our honeymoon night. Can you believe that? Was Steve supposed to bring her to the hotel the next morning? My father asked. Oh, no. He was supposed to mail the sheets. This woman gave him the sheets from her own marriage for us to use in the hotel. Now, does this make sense? Am I supposed to carry a can of beef blood around? Have you... Here you have Steve, educated, a gentleman, a mild-mannered man if there ever was one, and his mother's a sack of ignorance. I've said it all along. Steve may be educated, but his people come from the mountains. I listen all through the ride, back and forth about Uncle Steve. Everybody likes him. He's a college grad, a civil engineer, a naval officer, a trout fisherman, a tall, deep-voiced man with a well-trimmed mustache and formal manners. He plays poker with my father and uncles just to be sociable, and he's so unlucky at the game that one night he drew four aces, except that it was the first hand of the night and betting was almost nil. At the Archdiocese on First Avenue, I wait in the car while my father and Marie get their audience with the Cardinal. I read the sports section, then the news, then the op-ed page. I lean back in the seat and close my eyes, listening to the cyclic whir of traffic and the footfalls of passers-by. I'm used to waiting alone in the car for my father. Long before I learned to drive a car, my father would take me over the 59th Street Bridge and into the city. It was his way of being with me and seeing his girlfriends at the same time. We'd head down the East Side Drive, and he would ask me to repeat the names of all the bridges into Manhattan that he'd taught me. Then we'd turn into the city's cavernous streets and park seemingly at random. He would say, "Lock the door and wait here," and then disappear. I never saw him enter a store or building. He just walked down the street and disappeared. When he came back to the car, the conversation was always the same. "Where did you go?" I would ask. "I had to see somebody." "About what?" I asked. "Business." "What kind of business?" "Just some business." So now I wait once more. This time, while he and Aunt Marie meet with the Cardinal, or more likely one of his assistants, I can hear Marie BSing the priest with her gold crucifix and black lace, talking about St. Raphael's Parish on the West Side, about Vito's first Holy Communion, his confirmation, how he never missed his Easter duty, how his first wife couldn't conceive, and how his common-law wife gave him children duly baptized in the Roman Catholic Church. Then Hank moves in for the kill, taking out the envelope and saying, "Father, this is for the church. This is from our family." And I think about the mild-mannered Uncle Steve and how the beautiful black-haired Marie had probably wrapped him around her little finger with her worldliness and that very slight Italian accent, and how this little incident with the Cardinal only plays into the Marino view of the world as nasty and corruptible. I feel the whole weight of my family, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, all their stories and struggles and habits. The food and the beatings, the snails and clams and lamb's heads and salt cod and cannoli, the grapes my grandfather crushed every year, the voices, the card games, pinochle, poker, and briscola, the dialects and arguments exploding like cannon, those cannon that Lenny told me the Pope had blessed in World War II. Sometimes the burden of images makes me want to be like Uncle Steve, quiet, gentle, and a loser at poker.
The meeting is a success. And why not? Marie exclaims when they get back in the car. For enough money, you can buy a ticket to heaven. She reunited with Uncle Steve just after that, but he died of cancer within a year, something she knew about, but kept to herself to avoid the accusation, made anyway, that she'd only gone back to him for his pension. The burial is in New Jersey, and once again, I find myself driving, this time a new Thunderbird. My father's business was good, taking him and Aunt Marie to another funeral. My cousin Lenny is there, and he reads from his Bible at the graveside. It's a cold March day, and the cemetery is near a chemical plant, the wind wafting a nostril-biting smell like battery acid. Lenny wears a dark raincoat buttoned up to the collar, and he holds the Bible open, page corners flapping in the wind. Then he extends one hand toward us, waffling his palm. The place where Uncle Steve is going is nothing like what you see here, nothing like this world of poison and materialism. Lenny then reads a passage. Some men in uniform show up and fire off a two-gun salute. And when the ceremony is over, we drive to Steve's mother's house, where the table is crammed with fancy Italian cheeses and cold cuts and baskets of the chewiest, crustiest bread I've ever eaten. Steve's mother is a short, silver-haired woman with gold stud earrings who sits in a corner with a small plate of food and a tumbler of wine on the sideboard. Her little black eyes dart here and there, and when I call her Signora in my best accent and say I'm sorry about Uncle Steve, she's completely charmed. She calls over Steve's sister, Camille, who tells me how Uncle Steve had especially liked me because we had our education in common. She knew that I liked to fish, so she leads me through a bookcase-lined living room and down into the basement. There she offers me all of Uncle Steve's fly-fishing equipment. Bamboo rod, automatic reel, boxes of wet and dry flies, a fishing vest that fit, and a tackle box full of extra gear. When the reception is over, we get into the T-Bird and take the Jersey Turnpike north. Like a good wheelman, I keep to the middle of the lane, enjoying the knowledge that this big new car has all the power I want. It's a quiet ride, the T-Bird taking the potholes with a muffled bubble. The three of us studying the hazy expanse of highway, factory, and refinery. The old brick buildings with broken windows. All the ugliness that Lenny had cited. I was sad for Uncle Steve, but also thinking of the haul I'd made. The rod and reel, the boxes of expensive flies. And how every time I wade into a trout stream and cast a fly, I can think of what a gentleman Uncle Steve was, and that would bring me luck. After paying the toll at the George Washington Bridge, Marie says, "That's that." And we ride over the Hudson in silence, all of us smoking, Aunt Marie and myself with Paul Malls, Hank with an Antonio Cleopatra. And thus we zip into the city with the car windows wide open enough to flush our smoke with clean New York air. Finally, my father says, "Steve's mother wasn't very friendly back there." In the rearview mirror, I see Aunt Marie react with a very Italian gesture, a movement of her head and a slight "eh," as if to say that the obvious had been spoken. Then in Italian, she says, "She wouldn't be happy if he married the Virgin Mary." Marie died several years later. She was buried in New Jersey with Uncle Steve, maybe as close as they'd ever been. She didn't have much and left everything to my father, some jewelry kept in the freezer, an old Ford Crown Victoria, and a small piece of land bought long ago as an investment. My father and I went through her papers, and I found a packet of letters from some man who wasn't Uncle Steve. Each letter professed his love. Each had a poem with all the dramatic specificity of opera lyrics: your eyes, your hair, your beauty, your delicate touch. She'd met him on a cruise to Italy that she took with Aunt Gina, then a widow. Among her effects was a souvenir LP from the cruise, the album cover showing the ocean liner, the Cristoforo Colombo. Tucked inside was a photograph of the dining room and dance floor and pictures of Gina and Marie among the tourists, with corsages on their dresses, oversized hoop earrings, and bouffant hairdos. I play the album when I get home. All Italian tunes, the first cut called "Quando, Quando, Quando." Tell me, when will you come? When. Playing that song, I imagine my two aunts on board the cruise ship, first class, the height of their lives, both on the prowl. And while my father was putting in 16-hour days in his bar and grill, Gina and Marie were enthroned in the dining room with their armpit pads and girdles laced up tight, downing Manhattans, and later wine and veal and manicotti and pastries, cannoli and sfogliatelle and Napoleons, better than home, stuffing themselves until their girdle laces stretched to the breaking point. There were surely several dances with that writer of poetry, or with bald or silver-haired men, also traveling to Naples or Palermo, some married, some widowed, all of them lonely and on the make, and with that sad look in their eyes to fuel their poetry. All of them, men and women, looking for a new start.
The end.
Bravo.
Thank you.
Bravo, bravo, bravo. That is so filled with wonderful images, details, cultural gestures, but it's a great story.
Well, I tried to think about that story. There are how many characters in that story? There are quite a few characters in that story.
You're covering a lot of territory.
I think I did, I admit to, not to brag, but there are, I don't want to count them, probably six characters, and it's not a long story.
Well, I have to ask you, who's behind the wheel?
Oh, I'm behind the wheel by all means. Or no, my persona is behind the wheel. No, these things didn't happen that way. I mean, they're all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, life doesn't. I mentioned this at my reading when someone asked the same question. Life doesn't follow art. I mean, if you tried to write your life, it would be pretty boring. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, art or making a story gives form to life. So, all these experiences that happened in this story, for example, didn't happen this way or in this sequence. But I put them together to make something out of it. I mean, that's what you do as a writer.
Here.
I mean, you take your life and you make art out of it. So you have to lie, you have to exaggerate, or sometimes you have to tone things down.
Well, then let me ask you another question. Let's start with the Queensboro Bridge, and I want you to name them in order as you go down.
Oh, south. I can't do that.
You can't?
Probably not. Let me see. Brooklyn Bridge, Manhattan Bridge, Delancey Street Bridge.
Delancey Street bid, that would be the Williamsburg Bridge.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that's it. I think that's it. Is there another one? It's been a long time. there's another story in here where it's the same scene where he does name the bridges.
I read that, yeah.
The story is called Libation, and he goes by the Fulton Fish Market, and then he goes past a place called Sloppy Louis.
Fulton is just below the Williamsburg Bridge.
Yeah. Oh, it's been a long time, so no, I mean, when I wrote these stories, I'd have to say it's been a long time, so I'm not a great researcher. I don't really care about research in certain, mm-hmm. for something like this, although in this collection there is a story called The Mad Bomber, which is based on, it's based on a real event. There was a mad bomber in New York City, but... No, it's been a long time since I've been there. I left New York when I was 17.
Uh-huh, that young man.
And I never went back.
But related to all this is, what you've already partially described is, how close to home is this for you?
These stories are very close to home. One thing about these stories is almost all of them begin with a detail, and that's how they were written. The stories... I mean, I've written several novels, haven't published all of them, but novels are quite different. Stories come to me in pretty much of a rush. I usually write them either all the way through or halfway through and then finish them. They all start with a concrete detail that could be from anywhere, and then I put everything together. Original Sin starts with a scar over a person's eye. Mm-hmm. Lost Hearts starts with kids playing. I could just run through it. Starts with kids playing music and letting the stylus down on the spinning disc,
which was very, very expressive, by the way.
Powder Blue starts with a couple at a high school dance. The girl is wearing an Angora sweater, and the boys are dancing very close.
And her name is Marcella.
Yeah. Charlie Marino's Odyssey starts with a English teacher falling asleep in class. The Mad Bomber starts in a cafe and a sort of an ice cream parlor with a kid blowing smoke rings.
Can we back up to the Odyssey?
Sure.
Why the quotation about the Laestrygonians?
Oh, well, that quotation is from probably my favorite poet, Cavafy. And Do Not Fear the Laestrygonians is part of a poem that he wrote called Ithaca, a very famous poem. Actually was read at Jackie Kennedy's funeral. Mm-hmm. And Ithaca is really about the journey of life and how the journey is more important than life. You might never get to Ithaca, but it's the way you get there. Mm-hmm. So on the way, Odysseus in the Odyssey encountered the Laestrygonians, who were monsters who ate many of his men, and he escaped. But Cavafy's warning is, do not fear the Laestrygonians if you want to have a good journey in life. And in a way, these stories are filled with Laestrygonians.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things happen in these stories that are not that pleasant, but which to me I felt I had to write because I had to write. Basically, to write is to write the truth, and you, I know that as highfalutin as that sounds, you try to write what's true. If I can run down the stories, Wheelman starts with the ant holding up a piece of ham in the diner.
Thank you.
Chicken Feet starts with, it doesn't quite start with an image, but there's a central image in the story of chicken soup made with chicken feet. Fell starts with an incident. Porch Song starts with a bird singing. Pretty much they all start with an image. And from that I work in everything. These stories are very close. My novels that I've written are not quite as close, but they're also as close. But I think all writers have, not all writers, I can only speak for myself, but I mean if you read Philip Roth, are you getting Philip Roth, even though some of his characters are called Philip Roth?
Mm-hmm.
You might be and you might not be. Are mm-hmm. you getting Vincent Pinella? You might be and you might not be. Did these things happen? Some of them were imagined. Some of them are stories that I heard. I can't. It's hard to generalize. I know there. Obviously, I didn't read them all. I didn't live them all.
Mm-hmm.
Although one book that sort of influenced me is Pasolini's A Violent Life. I don't know if you've ever read that.
Oh, Pasolini, certo.
Yeah, Pier Paolo Pasolini's
si.
A Violent Life. I think when I read that, I saw a similarity between my writing and his,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of gave me a little bit of energy to finish these stories and to look at the stories in a way that I felt they had to be written. I didn't mm-hmm. want to back out of any of the stories. I hope I didn't. I mean, mm-hmm. the readers will have to judge.
Of course, Pasolini moved into those incredibly stark films.
Yeah.
Mm, amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and had a violent end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But when I read his book, A Violent Life, I think I saw similarities between what I was trying to do and what mm-hmm. he did. And being Italian, I mean, I'm an Italian-American, I think I'm always aware that even though I was born and raised in the United States, I always have that behind me, that culture. The culture of Italy is always sort of like saying, I know where I come from, I'm here, but I know what's behind me, and I know where I come from. And that's given me quite a lot. I think that's probably given me the energy to write in a kind of an aesthetic, like an attitude. I think it's given me a kind of an attitude. I like to have an attitude in my stories.
Well, another way of looking at it is that Italy is so rich, so incredibly rich,
right.
Culturally, historically, in every way that you look at it.
Right. The greatest events.
What a treasure house to draw on.
I know. If you think of Italy as some of the greatest events in history are the Roman Empire and the Renaissance, even though that's not... I could say that, okay, that wasn't particularly relating to southern Italy where my family is from. They're still part of that rich history. And my novel that I published, Cutter's Island, which is about Julius Caesar, actually resulted from an effort to explore the Mediterranean, to read about the Mediterranean. So I read, you know, Norman Grant and other writers. I read Plutarch, I read Herodotus, I read Suetonius, and I finally came upon the story about Julius Caesar, and I felt like I was ready to write the story because I was there. You know, I could relate to it even as a traveler in Italy. It's not hard to put myself back.
Uh-huh. When you're on the autostrada heading down into the crossing the Straits of Messina, there's a little road sign on the right that says... let's see. Oh, right. Yeah, this is that part of Italy where it's alleged that this is where the Odyssey took place.
Oh, Scylla and Charybdis.
Yeah, there's Scylla.
Yeah. Scylla is still there.
A little road sign.
And there's a town in Sicily called Caridi.
Right,
yeah.
Which was Charybdis.
I had my picture taken there when my first trip to Italy.
Okay. And then the Aeolian Islands. Also, there's
yep.
Vulcano,
right.
For instance. And
right.
They purport that the the Cyclops.
Right, exactly.
Cave is there and so forth.
Exactly, yes.
But the amazing thing, actually, when we were living on the Aeolian Islands, was the incredible sense of what really is the wine dark sea.
Exactly.
And the Aeolian Islands are just that, because the wind shifts again and again, and the color changes, the ripples change, the waves kick up, and yet you sit there and you look and, oh, well, there's Etna smoking, and I can see the lights of Palermo. And so
there's a book by Leonardo Sciascia, the Sicilian author, called The Wine Dark Sea.
Hmm.
And there's a title story, it's called The Wine Dark Sea. And one of the characters in the story says, I don't understand that metaphor, the wine dark sea. And I actually met a person who told me that she didn't understand the wine dark sea, and I didn't know how to explain it, but it is a perfect metaphor.
Oh, it is.
And the other aspect, I think, of my writing is that I look at writing as history. To me, writing is history. What I'm trying to do is bring out history, bring out people. I mean, lost hearts. I mean, I'm trying to bring out something that is lost.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, all writing is history. And the novels that I like best, the writing that I like best, that I really respond to, are novels that weave history into a human story.
Mm-hmm.
From Here to Eternity, for example, or obviously the great Russian novels, which anyone would aspire to. But I've always been drawn to novels that are stories that have history in them. And these stories, I tried to put history in. Some of the stories have the dates in the 50s built into them so you know exactly when they happen. And Original Sin, for example, is two-part story, starts in 1900, and then the second part is in 1950. So to me, history is important. I think to me, writing is history, even if you write science fiction or futuristic sort of things, it's still history. And everything, and the other thing about it is that every moment is unique. Even if you're a photographer, you can capture one moment. So it goes back to, is this really Vincent Pinella writing this? You don't know. I'll never capture the moment that happened, even if I try. You can't capture it.
Here.
As soon as you start to try to write about something that you're trying to remember, you've already changed it. I used this metaphor before in my last reading. It's like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. As soon as you shine a light on something, it changes. It'll scurry away. It changes the nature of something. So memory, I mean, we all know you can't remember anything the way it happened. So if I try to remember, in these stories, I might say, okay, I remember this, I remember... It isn't that way. In the story, for example, Wheelman, where the aunt holds up this this piece of ham and belittles the waitress. Well, that never happened. I actually had a friend who did that all the time, and we'd go into a restaurant and he would embarrass me, and we'd hold up this piece of ham and say, "What's this? What's this?" to the waitress, and it was very embarrassing to me. But I said, "You know, that gesture fits this character," so I gave it to her, and I think it worked. So that's how you do it. That's how I do it. Anyway, like I said, another image is that it's kind of like having a parts department. You have a bank. I have a bank of material. You're given, as a writer, a bank of material. I think William Styron said that you can learn experience enough in your first 25 years to write for the rest of your life. And this, I mean, Proust gave that a go.
He sure did.
So you don't really need, it depends on what kind of an observer you are. I think I'm pretty good at listening. I'm pretty ear oriented. I'm pretty good at dialogue. And I remember dialogue. I do. Even when I took language courses, I learned more easily by listening to people speak a language than studying that.
That's how we all start out as kids.
So, yeah, you have me and you don't have me.
Well, we know you went down the East Side Drive.
Oh, I did go down the East Side Drive, yes.
You know, getting back to Italy, I had this group of students. We stopped at Sperlonga, north of Naples, at a beach, go swimming, and looked down the length of the beach, and it looked like there might be some kind of an opening in the rocks down there. So we went down and explored and came to an extraordinary cavern. There were the caves dug into the cliffside. Huge vaulted ceiling, mosaics. We were in one of Tiberius's summer hideaways. There was a piece of rusty barbed wire strung across the front of the cavern, which you stepped over. And one of the students said, "Oh my God, look at these mosaics. Can I take one?" I said, "No, of course not. But there it is. Italy is spilling all over with these riches that they can't keep track of.
No. You can see their budget is pretty strained just to keep places like Venice in operation. It's a pretty expensive operation to keep all the tourists, not only the tourist places, but they really can't keep up with it. And if you go to Palermo, when the money sort of dries up when it heads south, if you go to Palermo, a lot of the statues and things like that in the city are in not very good shape because they just can't afford to do it all, or there's corruption or something like that. Or
right. But they were paying attention to the Opera House. That was impeccable.
Yeah, the Opera House, yes. Yes. But anyway, that's pretty much the way I write. I'm a concrete person. I like to know where my characters are. I'm not comfortable unless I know where my characters are. I write from scenes. I try to build in the hardest part of writing, besides writing for years and years and with very little success, the hardest part of writing for me is not dialogue or description or colorful language. I think for me the hardest part is dealing with time and working backstory in to give characters depth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty hard to do. And often when I read, I try to study how other writers do it. Writers like Coetzee, the South African, who's right now my favorite.
Uh-huh.
How they work in backstory, how they sketch in a character very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that character comes alive in a couple of lines. That's hard to do, and that's what I think I work hardest on.
Quick flashback. What did the Iowa Workshop do for you?
The Iowa Workshop was, for me, a terrific experience. I wrote my way in. I was a graduate student in English. I didn't like it. I really realized that I was more about putting things together than taking them apart, and I knew the workshop was there, and I, for the first semester, I had a kind of a lazy teacher who didn't do anything. But then I got into a section with a Southern guy named Bill Fox, William Price Fox, who was wrote a couple of short story books called Southern Fried. He wrote a bunch of novels. He was a screenwriter. He was a journalist. He was a working writer. And we had a great section there of... he encouraged all of us to write. I think he saw something in all of us. He talked about he did something that the other instructors there didn't do. He talked about his own life, his own writing. He passed around his own writing. He went, for example, at one point he had he was going to have a TV series on one of his based on one of his stories. It didn't work out, but he passed around the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
He did an article on Johnny Cash, which started out with his conversation in the taxi cab. And he told us, you know, the conversation never happened, how he invented that. So he actually taught us how to write in a way, not so much his writing style, because his writing style is different than mine, but he basically gave us the writer's work ethic. He encouraged us to write on spec if you couldn't get a job to write for free, but just to keep writing. And he was a busy guy. He did a lot of writing. And he taught us, really, he was sort of a model,
uh-huh.
a model of... how to be a writer, because he was a hard worker, and you really saw that this was what it required. It requires a tremendous amount of work and constant dedication. And he was like that, despite the fact that he was considered sort of a regional humorist. But he was a terrific guy. He loved his students, and I did well there. Some people didn't have a good experience in the workshop, but I did. I think there are some people who can't accept criticism, and they actually shoot themselves in the foot that way. I got into some classes there where people were pretty critical of each other, and some people, luckily I managed to survive that, but there were some pretty critical moments and sort of insulting moments at times, which I'm not sure that happens now. But the workshop, the other aspect of the workshop is I finally was in a world where other writers were like me, where other people were trying to do what I was trying to do. And until then, I had been just sort of in a vacuum. I didn't know any writers, really. I always wanted to write. I'd wanted to write since I was 19 and an engineering student, and I didn't like that, but I went through with it anyway. And I was always reading mostly, I started reading Homer. I think I started... my writing started when I was really young in the grade school, reading children's versions of the Trojan War. And then I went on to I read a lot of trash. Actually, I read a lot of trash history. I read a lot of westerns because I went going to school in New York. You didn't have the best guidance.
Hey, but don't forget the comic books.
But I gradually learned to read better stuff. But I read a lot of popular novels, and I loved them. I just ate them up. I used to write book reviews for my English class that I didn't really have to write, and I think that reading at some point. Walt Whitman was pretty influential. At some point you say, geez, I can do this. I think I can do this. After you read enough of it, you say, I think I'm going to try this. And that's what you do.
Yeah,
there's a story in here called Chicken Feet about a writer, about Charlie the writer, another manifestation of Charlie where he meets
In San Francisco.
He moves to San Francisco. He quits his job. He moves there to be a writer. And he actually runs out of money and leaves. But meanwhile, he has an adventure with his neighbor who's a It's quite an adventure. Yeah, it's called Chicken Feet. And I love that story. Mm-hmm. But that's an example of a story that didn't happen. I mean, there was a character like that. The Chicken Feet part is true.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest I just put together. I mean, I mean the Chicken Feet part was the core of the story, which drove me to write the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to create a story around it, so I had to move in Charlie and move in a writer moving next to this
and
this
move
kid.
In North Beach
and move
in
North
City
Beach.
Lights,
yeah, exactly.
And Mary Ferlinghetti.
Right.
And
but
it all
started
that.
With this chicken soup made out of chicken feet.
Yeah,
which this
it's
character.
It's a wonderful story.
I like that story a lot. I know.
Even Coit Tower.
Yeah, right. No, and actually, I went back there. I went back there about 5 years ago. My son was living there, and I went to the exact place where this chicken feet, this woman with the chicken feet, and it was totally, everything was the same physically, but it was just totally quiet and completely, everything was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to go back to places that I write about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know why, because it changes my perception. Actually, it ruins my fictional voice. If when I write about a place, I don't want to ruin it by going there and seeing it again. I want to reach for it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to reach for it as I remember it. And that's another something actually Thomas Wolfe said, that if you write better about a place if you're far away from it, because if you're far away from it, then you can isolate those details that really bring it out. If you're in it, there are too many distractions. It's too confusing.
You can't go home again.
Right, exactly. Okay, that's right. Maybe that's what he was trying to say.
What are you working on now?
I've been working on a novel for over 3 years.
Uh-huh.
I can tell you a little bit about it, and the reason why I don't like to talk too much about novels, or something that I'm working on, is because not only does it kind of jinx you, but novels change. You're liable to say something that will change when you. If I tell you in detail, and I'm not trying to be very gamey, but I'll tell you the source of this novel. It takes place in Queens, in Vermont, and what I've tried to do is work with a crime that happened in the schoolyard of my elementary school in Queens. In the late 90s, two gay men were murdered in the schoolyard of my Queens, in Queens, where I went to grammar school. I've been trying to think of what to do with that for a long time, but I didn't want to write a simple gay bashing story, sort of obvious story. And then while I was teaching in the law school, I came across a Supreme Court case which called Arizona v. Fulminante, which is about someone who committed a crime and was in jail for a different crime, but they suspected that he had committed a murder. And they sent an informant to live with him, to bunk with him, and the informant took his testimony. The informant basically told him that he could protect him from being beaten up by other prisoners if he would tell him the story.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was a mobster connected to organized crime. And anyway, it went up to the Supreme Court because it was basically a coerced testimony.
Sure.
It was coercion. Yeah. So I took these two elements of this. I had to throw out the characters from the Supreme Court case because I didn't want to deal with them. That took me a year. And I took those two crimes, they happened a couple of years apart, and I put them together with another. I just moved in another set of characters. This took quite a long time because it took me a year to write it, sort of with one set of characters.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized that it didn't work, and I wasn't interested in fictionalizing the real characters from this Supreme Court case. They were just didn't interest me. So I moved in another set of characters, and this took quite a while. And I've actually got the book to the point where structurally, it's kind of like a house that's completely framed with a roof on.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm just sort of filling in the rest. But I don't know. I'm very confident in it, and I've been. I'm going to finish it, and I think I'm hoping to finish it before the year is out. And I have. I'm crossing my fingers that I can get someone interested in it that will save me from this. Save me from the self-publication track I'm on right now, because it's a lot of work.
On the basis of the pleasure that I've derived from reading you, I think you'll find someone interested.
I hope so. I hope so.
You game?
Oh, yes. Would you like me to read this? I will. This is called...
This is the title.
This is the title story. It's called Lost Hearts. This is the first sighting of Charlie and his friends, although Charlie has less than a cameo role here. But this is about a group of 13-year-olds. It's a short story. It takes, I don't know, maybe 2 minutes to read. It's probably the shortest story in the book. It's called Lost Hearts. And here we go. Larry placed the disc on the turntable and lowered the stylus. He and Bobby heard that low, anticipatory static that preceded the music. The buzz before the storm. Then it came. Illinois Jackets Perdido. The trios of notes. Perdido, Perdido, I look for my heart, it's Perdido. The boy's introduction to the velvety riffs they would forever seek. The record belonged to Larry's older brother, and the bedroom where they listened could accommodate only the bunk bed, older brother on top, and two dressers pushed together. On Larry's dresser sat the plaster mold figures of the seven dwarfs he'd painted years earlier. These prefigured an interest in art he would later pursue. On his brother's dresser were the turntable and his beginner's jazz collection stacked between bookends. Jazz at the Philharmonic, James Moody, Charlie Parker, Earl Bostic, the cathedral of jazz the two 13-year-olds were now building. They sat on the bottom bunk and leaned back against the wall, looking up at the bedboards. "There's my brother's snot collection," Larry said, indicating the smeared, crusty deposits. They were a field of gravel in a moonscape of larger boulders, these being the wads of chewing gum which the brother had also stuck onto the slats. "He'll be home soon," Larry said. "We need to finish before that." The bell rang, and three more boys came in. Tommy, Buster, Charlie, and a short, stout boy whose receding hairline expanded the area of his face, which was always red, and because of this they called him Red Wall. The new arrivals, like Larry and Bobby, wore combat boots, garrison belts, and Eisenhower jackets studded with brass rivets. Larry turned off the music, and the boys sat around the table in the kitchen. It was a dark room whose feeble natural light came from a small window looking out on a brick wall. "What do we call ourselves?" one of them asked. Some names came up: gamblers, gents, bombers. The choice was narrowed down to gents and gamblers, and the latter was chosen after Larry sketched the symbol of a poker hand with four aces and a deuce. This would be the jacket emblem. "Where do we hang out?" "The schoolyard." "How often?" "Every day after school." "What's the initiation?" "Here and now, in blood." Larry took a long black comb from his back pocket, and holding it at one end, struck it hard against the knuckles of his fist. The teeth penetrated the skin, and Larry squeezed the skin around his knuckles until the blood came out of each tooth hole. The comb was then passed around until all knuckles bled. Each boy then pressed his knuckles against another's, fist to fist, until all had exchanged their blood. "Who do we beat up first?" A long discussion ensued. Redwall, later to become a psychotherapist, produced a list of three names, all older boys. One had cheated at blackjack and bullied his way out of it. One had bloodied Bobby's nose in a stickball dispute. Another had repeatedly thrown them off the handball court when they had been there first. His name was Leon. The vote was unanimous for Leon.
Bravo.
Thank you very much.
Vincent, what a pleasure.
It's been
a wonderful collection.
Well.
This is the Right Action Radio Hour. Your host is Edmund Brailsford. My guest today is Vincent Panella, and he's been reading from and talking about Lost Hearts, his most recent book, which is available locally. And this is the Right Action Radio Hour at WVEWLP 107.7 FM, Brattleboro Community Radio. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week. And thank you again so much, Vincent.
Thank you, Edmund. I enjoyed it very much.
Bye-bye.